Right, let's see. You're going to need a good pair of walking boots, a sun hat, and, well, watch out for falling rocks. Welcome to the Backpacker's Guide to Prehistory. Hello and welcome to the Backpacker's Guide to Prehistory, the podcast that provides top travel tips for time travellers. I'm your tour guide, David Mountain. Modern life is, for many of us, pretty good. The food is nice, there are flushing toilets, and each day brings yet another streaming service you didn't know you needed. In one respect, however, the modern era is really letting us down. Travel. Now, I don't mean that it's difficult to go on holiday, quite the opposite. Indeed, the fact that travel is now so easy is precisely the problem. Humans have become a species of holidaymakers. We've been everywhere, from the icy shores of Antarctica to the fiery depths of Nyiragongo. There's no path unbeaten, no stone unturned, no secret undiscovered. I don't know about you, but I'm looking for something a bit different. So, for the traveller who's seen it all, and the backpacker who wants to get away from it all, I can really recommend prehistory. That stretch of time before humans invented writing and streaming services and generally started messing things up. From the steamy swamps of the Carboniferous to the dazzling slopes of the Ice Age, prehistory is a treasure trove of natural wonders just waiting to be explored. And that's what this podcast is about, to provide practical travel advice for people interested in visiting the deep past. Each episode, I'll be asking experts in paleobiology about the most interesting, important, and exciting aspects of our planet's history. And if we happen to learn a few things about prehistory along the way, well, all the better. For simplicity's sake, we're going to class anything older than 10,000 years ago as prehistory, because it's around that time that humans really start to have a noticeable impact on the natural world. If 10,000 years ago sounds like a long time to you, don't worry. It still gives us more than 4.5 billion years of fantastic destinations to explore. So, let's get started. For our first episode, we're going to explore one of the most popular periods in Earth's history, the Cretaceous. Lasting from 145 to 66 million years ago, this enormous stretch of time has something for everybody. Amazing scenery, incredible plant life, dramatic geology, and some of the most iconic creatures that have ever walked the Earth. But backpackers beware, because Special K has more than its fair share of dangers. And you don't want to hang around too long either, because the Cretaceous ends with an almighty bang. To help me explore the Cretaceous and uncover some of its hidden secrets, I've enlisted the help of two experts. Dr. Max Stockdale, a paleontologist at the University of Bristol.
Hello.
And Dr. Monica Carvalho, a paleobiologist with the Smithsonian Tropical Research Institute.
Hi, David.
Monica, first things first, I'm going to the Cretaceous, I'm packing for my holiday. What clothes should I bring?
Well, I would suggest bringing clothes for really, really warm weather. So back in the Cretaceous, things were very warm. Overall, in the world, there were no ice caps, which means that global temperature was a lot warmer. And depending on exactly where you want to go, it's going to be either extremely warm, such as in the tropics, or kind of like a warm summer day in higher latitudes.
That sounds quite nice. I'm not very good with warm weather. You can see I'm a pasty guy, so I might have to stick to the higher latitudes for this holiday. Do we know why it's so warm in the Cretaceous?
Well, one of the reasons that we think it was a lot warmer back then It's because of CO2. So there is a lot of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere back then. This carbon dioxide was probably due to a lot of volcanic activity that was happening as Gondwana, so the continent that was made up by what today is Africa, South America, Antarctica, was splitting up. And with that split up, there was a lot of volcanic activity throwing CO2 and other gases into the atmosphere, which made it really, really toasty back then.
With these toasty conditions, as you put it, what habitats can I expect to travel through in the Cretaceous? Are we talking desert or jungle? What habitats were common back then?
Jungles were pretty common, but the jungles were very different to what we know today. So back then, we're in the age of the rise of flowering plants. So today, almost everything you see, every plant you see when you look out the window, most of it are flowering plants. They produce fruits, so we rely on them for food. But back then, they were just beginning to diversify. They did so pretty fast, but it seems that they really did not become as dominant as they are today until the end of the Cretaceous. So you're going to see a lot of jungle, but that jungle is going to be made mostly of a lot of ferns, a lot of conifers, and then some bushes, some large trees of flowering plants. It's going to be very, very different. It's going to be a lot easier to walk around, though, because if you go today to a rainforest, a tropical rainforest, say, it's very hard to walk around. There's plants everywhere. There's vines intertwined with everything. So you cannot really walk very easily. Back then, forests were a lot more open. So you could probably take hikes all around while you're exploring and looking out for Tyrannosaurus or Triceratops.
Good. It makes it easier to run away as well.
Exactly.
So you mentioned some of the plants that I might see, the ferns and conifers. Are there any flowering plants that I might recognize from today in the Cretaceous?
Some of them. Magnolia trees, for example. We know that there were some magnolia trees back then, which presumably they would also be making those, you know, large showy flowers that we know today. Really, really beautiful how they synchronize and flower in early spring.
So were the seasons the same in the Cretaceous as now? Was there still a spring and an autumn, or with all that warm weather and that CO2, was it more equitable throughout the year?
It was equitable, a little bit more equitable throughout the year, but there were definitely seasons, because seasons are not controlled only by temperatures. Temperatures are a byproduct of seasons. So in high latitudes, we would definitely expect longer days in the summer, shorter days during the winter. And even up in the Arctic, because there were no ice caps, there was life up there. There were dinosaurs roaming around. There were also a lot of plants, but most plants would kind of shut down for almost 6 months of the year during wintertime, and then wake up during summertime and have these really, really long periods where they were just growing and doing photosynthesis and being food for a lot of large herbivores.
It's amazing. So it's kind of very extreme winter with no light and then suddenly 6 months of summer.
Exactly.
Okay, so I don't want to be there in the winter because I won't see anything.
No, you would probably see very, very nice northern lights, definitely.
Oh yeah, that's true.
But it would be cold. And yeah, it would be a lot harder to spot animals if that's what you're into.
Yeah, that's true. So you mentioned a bit earlier just about how successful flowering plants are today. I mean, it's about 90% of all the plants you see in the world. Essentially, if it's not a conifer, a fern, a moss or a liverwort, it's probably a flowering plant. So what's their secret? What makes them so successful?
That's a great question. And we don't really know exactly, but it might be a combination of factors. So overall, flowering plants, they grow a lot faster and they do a lot better than either conifers or ferns or liverworts or mosses. And they do this because their photosynthetic rates are higher. That comes together with a particular type of leaves, which, you know, leaves, they have these reticulate pattern. Their veins make this reticulate pattern. And that kind of gives them an advantage at being a lot more efficient in water transport and sugar transport. Another thing is that they produce flowers. So flowers are these really beautiful structures, really highly modified structures that either attract pollinators or are highly specific at capturing pollen, in the case of grasses, for example. And this may have favored, you know, the evolution of flowers because they were speeding up, you know, bringing pollinators, having pollinators bring their pollen to them instead of just relying on wind to be dispersing it. The same would happen with fruits. So all flowers end up being fruits. Fruits can be many types. You know, we're most familiar with the fruits that we eat, right? You know, who doesn't love an avocado? Who doesn't love a banana? And we are dispersers, right? So when we eat, we're kind of sending plants around. We could even think that we've been domesticated by plants in order to spread them around.
I like that.
So with the evolution of fruit, maybe there's also a lot of coevolution with dispersers. So they both became angiosperms, flowering plants, both became a lot more efficient in pollination and in dispersing their fruits and their seeds.
Max, another important topic we should discuss is travel, simply getting around the Cretaceous world. Because this is a little more difficult than it has been in previous periods, given that the continents, which were previously fused into one supercontinent, Pangaea, are now breaking up. Earlier, Monica mentioned that Gondwana, the enormous southern continent, is splitting apart. But how exactly is Pangaea breaking up? I mean, what landmasses are going where in the Cretaceous?
So Pangaea started breaking up in the middle of the Jurassic period, and it was sort of still moving away from its original position by the time the Cretaceous started. We were sort of midway through the Cretaceous period, it had separated into two main landmasses. There's a northern landmass, which was made up of North America, Asia, and Europe. And then there was a southern landmass, which was made up of South America, Antarctica, and Australia. And Africa and India were sort of moving towards their modern day positions. They're sort of heading north between the two. And by the time the Cretaceous came to an end, the continents were sort of very, very much moving towards their modern day positions. So these two northern and southern landmasses had broken up. And there were features that we would recognize today. So the Atlantic Ocean had formed. It was only half as wide as it is today. So it actually would have been probably a good time for you to go across to the United States.
We also heard from Monica how this tectonic rifting is associated with a lot of volcanism. And backpackers do need to be aware that the Cretaceous is home to a lot of active volcanoes. Max, are there any specific locations that backpackers should avoid if they don't want to be incinerated on their holiday?
That's a very good question. So volcanism is a very widespread phenomena throughout the globe in the Cretaceous period. But there's one particular region in the Cretaceous which you probably want to stay away from. And this is a region that's called the Deccan Traps, which is in India. And this is what we call a flood basalt. It's a type of volcanism that we don't really see in the world today. And it would have been many millions of cubic kilometers of lava covering vast areas of the planet's surface. So yes, it's a very, very good way to avoid being incinerated is to avoid going to India.
Sound travel advice, thank you. Now, another factor making travel difficult in the Cretaceous, besides the endless plains of molten rock, are the sea levels.
Absolutely. So the sea level during the Cretaceous period was much higher than it is today. And that would have caused a great deal of flooding inland. So we've got these sort of inland oceans which have formed, which is completely dry land today. And there's a few different reasons for why the sea level is rising. One of them are these mountain building episodes. So as the Atlantic Ocean and the ocean basins open up, there would have been a buildup of rock on the seafloor, and that will have displaced much of the seawater, which is simply not enough room for it. So it would have spilled out onto the land. Also, there's a climatic factor going on, that it's much warmer in the Cretaceous period than it is today. So there would have been no ice caps at the poles, and the fact that there was no Arctic ice, all that water's got to go somewhere, so it would have been in these shallow ocean basins inland. And also there's the other factor that just because it was warmer, water expands when it's warm. So it would have physically taken up more volume than it does today. So there would have been a lot more water around just in general.
Now, Max, we can't talk about the Cretaceous without talking about dinosaurs. This is, after all, the age of dinosaurs. So when I'm walking around in the Cretaceous, what are the chances that I'm going to bump into one of these animals? Just how common were dinosaurs back then?
I think the likelihood of you bumping into a dinosaur is extremely high. The Cretaceous period, this is kind of the golden age of dinosaurs. They were at their height. There were a number of different lineages which have occupied every possible sort of ecological niche, every ecological interaction that you can think of. And actually, there's many more that we won't have discovered yet, because the fossil record is extremely skewed towards the types of dinosaurs that make the best fossils. There's going to be many more that we haven't discovered yet. And they range enormously from, obviously, the giants that we see in children's books, these sauropods with the great long necks and their big stomachs full of vegetation, right the way down to tiny, tiny animals no bigger than a hummingbird that would have occupied every niche you can imagine, whether they're catching insects or catching small lizards, and even up to giants like tyrannosaurs hunting other big dinosaurs.
So you mentioned that the incredible diversity of dinosaurs in the Cretaceous. What lineages were the most common, do we think?
That's a very good question. That's something that the field is still trying to work out, because quite often with the fossil record, you have these gaps, and superficially it looks like the animal is absent. But then upon closer inspection, you realize actually it's just that there's no fossils. It doesn't mean that the animal isn't there in a particular environment. So for a long time, it was thought that these giant long-necked dinosaurs had fallen out of favor during the Cretaceous period, that they were not very common. But some recent analysis has suggested that actually these giant long-necked dinosaurs were doing pretty well during the Cretaceous period, and not just in the Southern Hemisphere, in the Northern Hemisphere as well. So that field is still opening up. But there's certainly groups of dinosaurs that were extremely common during the Cretaceous period. In particular, there were herds of beaked dinosaurs. There's a number of different sorts. So there would have been sort of four-legged beaked dinosaurs with horns. Triceratops is a very famous example. And these animals would have been living in huge herds throughout the Northern Hemisphere, particularly towards the end of the Cretaceous period. And another variety of dinosaur, there would have been what we call the duck-billed dinosaur, things like Parasaurolophus, which you might have seen in Jurassic Park, the duck-billed dinosaurs that would also formed huge herds, and they would have been around much earlier than the horned dinosaurs would have been.
That's really interesting about the sauropods, the long-necked dinosaurs, because I've always been telling people, if you want to see them, go to the Jurassic. But that advice is a bit out of date now.
Yes, so the Jurassic is definitely a very good time to go and see sauropods. And actually, there's arguably probably a greater morphological diversity of sauropods in the Jurassic, because there are these, in the Jurassic period, you have these, the diplocids, these long-necked, long-tailed, rather sort of low-slung kind of creatures. And there were also the brachiosaurids, these ones with the very, very long necks, that were very tall creatures, which would browse on the tops of trees. And that sort of variation declines somewhat, it seems, in the Cretaceous period. And they sort of stick to a more generic body plan. But in the Cretaceous period, sauropods get very much bigger. And some of the Cretaceous sauropods are absolutely gigantic. They're some of the largest animals that have ever existed on land. So, yeah, it depends on what you're looking for in your sauropods. If you're looking for sort of morphological variation, I would definitely say go to the Jurassic. But if you want to look at the really big ones, the Cretaceous is for you.
Now, I'm sure you've had this before. When you tell people you're going to the Cretaceous, everyone says there's one thing you have to do, and that's to see a Tyrannosaurus rex. Now, I know that T-Rex is an icon of prehistory, and rightly so, but I'm beginning to wonder if T-Rex isn't a little overrated these days. I suppose I'm asking, are there more interesting or unusual dinosaurs that I should be looking out for instead during the Cretaceous?
That's a good question. I can certainly think of a few species of dinosaur that come immediately to mind as being particularly interesting, and some of these have only come to light in recent years. In particular, there's a dinosaur called Spinosaurus. Spinosaurus was discovered way back at the beginning of the 20th century, but its remains were extremely fragmentary, so we've not actually got very much material to go on. But as the years have gone by, researchers have found more pieces, and it's come together, and Now we've got a pretty good idea of what the complete specimen, what the complete animal was like in life. And it seems to have been a very, very strange animal indeed. In particular, it's got this really long, thin, crocodile-like snout. It's clearly adapted for catching fish. It's got this weird sort of sail running down its back. We don't really know what that was for. It could have been a behavioural signal, perhaps a way of communicating between individual species. And it had this long sort of fin running down its tail, which seems to have been an adaptation to swimming. It seems very likely that Spinosaurus was actually living rather like a crocodile, spending much of its life in water. Something that 10 years ago we would have said was unthinkable, because we always assumed that all dinosaurs lived on land, but actually it seems that some of them were quite well adapted to living in water.
Fantastic. I'm adding that to my list of things to see in the Cretaceous, although maybe at a distance.
Yes. Yes, you certainly want to keep a safe distance. Spinosaurus is definitely very big, and despite the fact it was adapted to catching fish, would definitely have been very capable of causing serious injury to a land animal if it wanted to.
I actually did want to talk about safety in the Cretaceous, because as with Spinosaurus, although maybe not to that extent, a lot of animals in the Cretaceous, dinosaurs and others, come equipped with very sharp claws and very sharp teeth, and lots of them. I mean, even the birds had teeth. So, and I want you to be honest with me here, Max, what are the chances that I will be eaten alive on my holiday?
I think you're going to have to be careful. There are lots of hazards to these late Cretaceous animals, although I have to bear in mind that there are hazards to wild animals today. So I think it's probably a balance that you have different risks to exploring wildlife in the past than you have today. For example, the very big meat-eating dinosaurs, it's obviously very tempting to think of them as these sort of lethal killing machines that you could never go up against. And actually, in practice, I think maybe it would have been quite different. There's been a debate in recent years about whether Tyrannosaurus rex was an active hunter or not. There's some researchers who have claimed that they believe it's a scavenger. I personally don't believe that, because the evidence is based on things like the length of its arms. Everybody's laughing at the tiny little arms that Tyrannosaurus rex has. But actually, it seems to my mind that actually Tyrannosaurus is rather like a shark. Its killing technique is adapted around its head, so it just didn't need the arms. It's not that it was inadequate in any way for not having them. There's also the other thing, there's quite compelling evidence that Tyrannosaurus rex would have hunted in groups, maybe attacking other large dinosaurs. So to be honest, I'm not really sure a human would have been worth the effort that it would have taken to catch them. So there's been plenty of biomechanical studies that have suggested that actually Tyrannosaurus rex wasn't a particularly fast runner. And they would have been so top heavy that it would have been quite easy to trip one up if you were confronted by one. And if you're a 5-ton animal that's standing 5 meters tall, a fall could be fatal. So actually, Tyrannosaurus rex and some of these big meat-eating dinosaurs, I don't know for sure that they would have been a particular threat to humans. On the other hand, many of the smaller meat-eating dinosaurs, I imagine they could have been extremely dangerous. If you think of a cassowary, which is a large bird that lives in Australia today, it's only about 5 feet tall. It's not a particularly imposing creature by dinosaur standards, but they are lethal and they can seriously injure or even kill a human being if they have a mind to. And the world of the Cretaceous period was full of animals like that.
If anyone's listening to this and starting to feel anxious, don't worry. Because in the Cretaceous, like in all time periods, and that includes the present day, you just need to exercise a little common sense. So don't go near nests or young, don't get in the way of them, and just keep your distance. So, like you say, the same with modern animals.
Absolutely, yes. There's also the other thing to bear in mind, that we, as humans, we smell like mammals. So to a dinosaur, they would probably associate the smell of a mammal with something that was very small and insignificant and probably not worth chasing. And also, by the same token, herbivores might not necessarily have felt particularly threatened by the smell of a mammal. So on the basis of smell, you might hope that dinosaurs might actually and probably wouldn't pay that much attention to you at all.
Well, that's another good travel tip. Don't worry about getting too stinky in the Cretaceous, because it might just save your life. Now, we've talked a lot about land animals, but what about if I was going to head into the water? Now, I don't really need to tell you that I'm not the biggest water sports enthusiast. I think the angriest I've ever been was in a kayak. However, I know that there are backpackers who like to paddle and surf and banana boat. But my question is, are they putting themselves at risk by trying to do these activities in the Cretaceous?
Yes, going for a swim or going canoeing in the Cretaceous period is probably not a good idea, whichever way you slice it, because the oceans during the Cretaceous period, they are full of very large and quite terrifying marine animals, not just reptiles, but fish as well. And these are animals would have been very capable of sinking a boat, of killing and seriously injuring a human being. So we're including animals like very famous plesiosaurs, animals with very long necks and four large flippers that would have rowed themselves to the oceans. They were adapted for catching fish and were particularly interested in attacking a land animal, but they would certainly have been capable of causing a great deal of harm to a person. And that's just sort of the relatively benign end of the spectrum of marine reptiles. They go up to animals like mosasaurs, these huge seagoing lizards from the Cretaceous period that would have been, very, very large and extremely ferocious predators.
So I think one piece of advice here is leave your banana boat at home if you're going to the Cretaceous.
I would say so, absolutely.
I would say, however, that the single most important piece of travel advice in the Cretaceous is simply this: avoid the end Cretaceous. I'm talking 66 million years ago, because we know that during that time, life on Earth suffered a mass extinction. Monica, what happened at the end of the Cretaceous to cause this mass extinction?
Oh, gosh. The end of the Cretaceous was this massive ecological catastrophe. So we really think of it in terms of, either volcanic activity that was happening around India or the impact of a giant asteroid that hit near the Yucatan Peninsula. But really, what ended up causing the extinction was the ecological collapse that occurred after that impact. So we have a lot of, resolution. We know now that it was due to this impact that crashed into the Earth, and it just thousands and thousands of tons of rock just vaporized, flying out into the air. Then giant tsunamis occurred, earthquakes occurred, and all this vaporized rock, as it was falling back onto the ground, it started warming up due to friction with the air, so triggered a rain of fire, almost burning forests all over the world, which in turn would create a lot more ashes, a lot more dust, a lot more soot going out into the atmosphere and darkening the skies for years. So it was that scenario, that ecological catastrophe, that shut photosynthesis down around the world and ended up killing, all the large herbivores, in consequence, all the large carnivores, and affecting the ocean for a really, really long time.
Now, you say a really long time. Do you know how long it took for plant communities around the world to recover fully, to get back to where they were before that impact?
It's very interesting because plant communities didn't recover per se. They changed a lot. So around the world, extinction for plants was not homogeneous. So extinction, it seems to be, it was a lot harsher the closer you were to the impact site. So if you're in Patagonia, in southern part of South America, extinction didn't seem to be so harsh. So around only 10% of plant species went extinct. And only a couple million years later, we see these forests that are already pretty diverse and have herbivores that are highly specialized on feeding on these plants, and they're also pretty diverse. Whereas if you're in the tropics, like in northern South America, the catastrophe was a lot harsher. So around 45% of species went extinct. And then the new communities didn't recover in terms of diversity for about 8 million years.
Wow. I think people always think of the Permian Triassic as the one that took a really long time to recover from, but 8 million years, even in geological terms, that's enormous.
That's a long time, but that's for diversity to recover. Forests were probably growing back, or plants were probably growing back several decades, a couple hundred years after the impact, but that was probably a very, very slow process.
So you do get some kind of thrill seekers, the people who like to go tombstoning and watch volcanoes erupt, and they say they want to go to the end Cretaceous to see the impact happen. They want to get that shot, that classic impact shot. What's your advice to them?
Wow. They have to be really, really fast at taking that picture because the asteroid was coming very fast against the Earth. Yeah, so I mean, if you really want to capture the shot, you have to be around the Gulf of Mexico, right? So you have to be around there. But it's going to be a very, very bright light. So I would definitely suggest, you know, trying your camera first to have the exact setting that you would want in order to capture the image.
That's good advice. So, Max, we've heard from Monica how the impact at the end of the Cretaceous effectively shut down photosynthesis for years. Can you elaborate a bit more on how that affected the dinosaur communities that ultimately depended on plants?
Yes, so the process of by which the dinosaurs actually became extinct is not completely clear. We haven't completely worked it out yet. The impact would certainly have had a huge impact on the climate, as well as you say, it would have been to shut down photosynthesis. So one thing that definitely would have done the dinosaurs a big problem would have been that the lack of food for the herbivorous dinosaurs, all these big plant eaters, they would have needed to eat vast amounts of vegetation. And with that gone, they would have starved. They would have just had nothing to eat fairly quickly within the first few months. There would have then been a temporary sort of glut of food for scavengers. There would have been a period when meat-eating dinosaurs would have done quite well because there would have been so many corpses around for them to snack on. But eventually, the supply of food would run out. And one of the things that seems very clear is that body size was a very major factor in what caused the dinosaurs to become extinct, because there's a very clear sort of cutoff point that animals above a certain size did not survive. And animals below a certain body size, they had a greater probability. There were plenty of small organisms which did go extinct, but it was certainly body size was a big factor in dictating who survived and who didn't. Like I say, there's huge climate impacts as well. In particular, there's been some recent research that suggests the meteorite impacted an area of calcium sulfate, that is gypsum. And in the process of vaporizing that gypsum, it would have ejected a great deal of sulfur into the atmosphere that would then turn into acid rain. And that would have been very unpleasant for plants and animals alike.
You mentioned the range of animals that went extinct, because, of course, it wasn't just dinosaurs. And I should be clear, I mean non-avian dinosaurs here, those that didn't evolve into birds. So what animals besides those dinosaurs also became extinct at the end of the Cretaceous?
So the giant marine reptiles, the ones that I was cautioning you about earlier not to go swimming with, they went extinct around the same time as the dinosaurs. There's a particular group called the ichthyosaurs, which seem to have become extinct slightly earlier, but they were replaced by the mosasaurs and they were finished off by the end Cretaceous impact. Another group that went extinct were the pterosaurs. The pterosaurs were a group of flying reptiles, not related particularly to birds. They had membranous wings, rather like a bat, and it would have included examples like Pteranodon from the Jurassic Park movies. And it seems they became extinct around the same time as the dinosaurs, and probably for similar reasons. But there's also evidence of members of our own lineage, the mammals, that became extinct. There were lineages of mammals in the Cretaceous period which disappear around that time. Some of them survive into the more recent times, and obviously they are the ones that are our ancestors.
Well, that's nearly time. But since mass extinctions tend to be a bit of a downer, I'd like to end instead by asking both my guests for their one top recommendation for the Cretaceous period.
For me, I think I would say stay at home, because actually the United Kingdom during the Cretaceous period, I reckon it would have been a pretty great place to go on holiday, because during the Cretaceous period, the European continent was much closer to the equator than it is today, so it would have been much warmer. And it would have been an archipelago of small islands, because like I was saying earlier, the high sea level would have inundated much of the European continent. So the high ground would have formed these little islands. And actually, received wisdom is that it would have been rather like the Cayman Islands or the Caribbean today. So it had these pristine white carbonate sand beaches and maybe beautiful azure blue water, which you want to stay out of, as I was saying, but it still looks nice. So I would have said maybe head down to somewhere like Portsmouth or Southampton or the Isle of Wight, and just go and have a stroll along the beach.
That sounds wonderful. And Monica?
I would love, I mean, for me, I would love to go see these cat-sized pterosaurs that lived in around British Columbia. I think they would make great pets.
Oh, so you're going to bring one back?
I would love to bring one back. I find that a cat-sized pterosaur would be so cute.
And all that's left for me to say is thank you very much to my two guests, Dr. Monica Carvalho and Dr. Max Stockdale, for sharing their Cretaceous travel advice. If you've enjoyed what we've been talking about today, then do check out their work and their research, because they're doing really exciting stuff. You'll find the relevant links in the episode notes. I'd also like to thank Neil Doherty and Charlie Solomon for their advice on recording and making podcasts, Abby Rumsey, even though she's never seen Jurassic Park, for being my one-woman IT team, and Max Stockdale again. Yes, I know he was a guest, but he also helped me out behind the scenes. And most of all, thank you to you for listening. I hope you've enjoyed this episode, and if you have, please feel free to like, subscribe, share, and leave a positive review. And I hope you'll join us again for another episode of The Backpacker's Guide to Prehistory. But until then, safe travels.